This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by Bluehost. It is a great company for your website or blog and very affordable. Just $6.95 per month. You get great service and support and very easy setup of your blog. Just one click of a button. So even if you're not technical, you can focus on your content. I love it. I use it for my own blog at fatherroderick.com. Go to sqpn.com/bluehost for more information. And by the Amazon store. Click on the link on our website, thehobbit.sqpn.com, before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show.
sqpn.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Where to begin?
Hello and welcome back to a brand new episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit, the podcast dedicated to the book by J.R.R. Tolkien, but also, of course, to the movies currently in production. We've seen the first one, the next one is just around the corner, and the third one is going to be in theaters next year. We've been following the developments, but there's been a big, big hiatus, and I have to apologize for that. I've been traveling so much. I've been to Brazil, to France, and very recently to Australia and New Zealand. I actually went to a number of the places that were used for The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. So I've got some stories to tell about that. But today, we are going to talk about the new official theatrical trailer. And as we used to do on the show, we're gonna dissect it frame by frame and tell you what we see, what we think we see, and what it all means. And joining me today are two new co-hosts, Bethany and Riley Blanton, brother and sister. And joining us to talk about The Hobbit and about Tolkien, but you guys are actually also into Star Wars, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. My brother and I do a Star Wars podcast called Star Wars Report, and but we're quite excited to be on the show. Thanks for having us, Father.
Well, I am excited that you want to join us, and it's so great to find podcasters that are also Star Wars fans and are also huge Hobbit fans and Tolkien fans. How did that get into your life, Bethany?
Well, I've been into Star Wars for quite some time, but I've actually enjoyed Tolkien's Middle Earth universe for longer. My father introduced me to The Hobbit when I was a child, and I haven't stopped loving Tolkien since. I used to beg to stay up late to read The Hobbit, and I did the same when I read The Lord of the Rings as well.
And I bet you that you've read the books several times.
I have indeed, yes.
Very good. It's right what we need because, of course, one of the things that we always love to talk about is the differences also between the movies and the books. And this trailer actually gives us ample material to talk about. What about you, Ryan? What does Tolkien mean to you?
I'm given the bequeathed the hobbity name of Riley, which is funny because that's my grandparents' name. So yeah, but yeah, as far as The Hobbit goes, it's interesting. There's a lot of crossover between Star Wars and Tolkien, and really much of in modern times of what we would call high fantasy, which I think Star Wars certainly qualifies, and The Hobbit more than qualifies. It is nice to see that there is a crossover there. And I'll tell you what, Father, it was the year was 2011 by Shire Reckoning. And I had the opportunity to listen to some episodes, quite a backlog of The Secrets of the Hobbit, and man, and really into 2012, as I spent my summers mowing, earning college money, for which is where I am now. That's a lot of what I listen to. So it's actually very surreal and very exciting to actually be here talking about one of my favorite authors of all time with you. So thanks for having us.
Well, I'm just super excited to talk with two big, big Tolkien fans about this trailer, because let's waste no more time. There is so much to talk about. I doubt that we can keep this short, but we don't have any intention to do that. But before we launch into our analysis, let's first play that trailer one more time. I'm sure that most of our listeners have seen it 100 times, but just to bring us in the mood for the desolation of Smaug.
Truly, the tales and songs fall utterly short of your enormity, O Smaug the Stupendous.
We are the dwarves of Erebor. We have come to reclaim our homeland.
I offer you my help.
Now that we know it won't betray us.
We don't. There is no king under the mountain, nor will there ever be.
It will not end here. With every victory, this evil will grow.
Legolas has grown very fond of you. Do not give him hope where there is none.
You have no right to enter that mountain.
I have the only right.
We've been blind. In our blindness, our enemy has returned.
I found something in the Goblin Tunnels.
What did you find?
My courage.
Good. You'll need it.
Dragonfire and ruin.
That is what you will bring upon us. He cannot see beyond his own desire.
I will not risk this quest for the life of one burglar.
His name is Bilbo.
Wow. Thief. Where are you? Come now. Don't be shy. Step into the light.
Step into the light, the desolation of Smaug. And we get to hear Smaug. That, for me, was the highlight of this trailer. I mean, there's so much cool stuff in this trailer, but just hearing Benedict Cumberbatch's voice, which is the one thing that we hadn't seen or hadn't heard yet, I was so excited. And what about you, Bethany? What was your first reaction to the trailer?
My overall reaction to the trailer was definitely one of excitement. I was thrilled to see everything that was in it and very interested to see the parts that I know haven't come from the book, but I'm interested to see what they do with that. But I will say, I think I felt just a bit of Bilbo's terror when I heard Benedict Cumberbatch's voice, because let's face it, he makes a great villain.
He definitely does. And it was so surprising to hear. Well, of course, they've modified his voice tremendously to make it dark and menacing and booming. And yet you can still tell that it's Benedict Cumberbatch. It doesn't completely take away, well, his character in a way.
But it's interesting because Benedict Cumberbatch in recent years has become such a staple of pop culture. I wonder if initially when they cast him, if they were thinking of you, because he already has a great, deep, thunderous, powerful voice. But mm-hmm. I wonder if they decided to kind of use that that alteration maybe a little bit so that you didn't say, oh, that sounds like the guy from Star Trek, or that sounds like Sherlock. I wonder if they're trying to distance themselves a little bit to give it more of a unique sound.
It's possible, but then again, you know, with Gandalf, you have the same problem. It's like, oh, that's the guy from the X-Men. And
yes,
I think that we're willing to kind of forget about that and just let ourselves be enchanted by the acting and the quality of the acting of all these people.
And I think any parallels drawn there to actually work, because Sherlock is an incredibly intelligent person, the way that Cumberbatch plays his character.
Yes.
Very, very keen. He's a very keen intellect.
And in a way also a bit vain and likes to be praised and recognized.
Yes.
There are parallels there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then the chemistry between the two actors in Sherlock is so fantastic that I'm just really eager to see how, if that same chemistry is here, I assume it is. But then again, the acting circumstances are so different. I mean, this is all special effects and it's all motion capture. And so, but these actors are so amazing that I just can't wait to see more of that confrontation between the dragon and the Hobbit. So let's go over the trailer frame by frame. And I've got 4 pages of notes here in front of me. It's just unbelievable how much they stuffed into this trailer. This, of course, also because it's no longer a teaser trailer like the previous one, which actually already showed quite a bit. But it is the official theatrical trailer, so it has its function is to really make us want to see this movie and also to remind us of certain things. That's, I think, why there is the emphasis right in the middle of the trailer on the ring, because, of course, you also have to reach that audience that might not have seen the first movie but still has that association with hobbits, and, well, the ring has to be there, so it's there, even though in the original story it's not as important as it is in The Lord of the Rings. So let's start with the first scene. There's a little bit of interference on the line. I apologize. That's Skype doing that. Just imagine that there is a dragon breathing somewhere in the corner. It just adds atmosphere.
Yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch's deep voice as it comes.
There you go. So the first thing that struck me was the music. Very different from what we've heard in the first movie. Also different from what we've heard in the teaser trailer. It kind of reminded me of Once Upon a Time. I'm not sure if that's because of the instruments. But what did you think about the music in the trailer?
It's gone. Oh, look at yay! That. Or at least the sound is for me.
Not the
but,
music.
I really liked the music in the trailer because it did sound a bit like the music that you hear in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I heard some
especially there were
strands
kind of two movements
sort of,
there.
Yeah.
You had the first one, which was very, very kind of mysterious, and then it really went to a kind of a full Lord of the Rings-esque Two Towers era.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. It reminded me of the music that you hear often in Rohan.
Of course, we don't know for sure if this is really music that we're going to hear in the second movie, because often for trailers, they will just use kind of staple action music, and sometimes trailers actually use the same music for various movies. But I thought it was very kind of, the music kind of fit what we saw.
For sure. And Father, if you've noticed, as far as the music goes, it's interesting because the Lord of the Rings films, I don't know if it was with the Fellowship of the Ring, but I do know with the Two Towers and Return of the King, those theatrical trailers used score from the films, but the Hobbit films have not done that so far. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, except that you could argue that the song when Thorin sang it,
that's true
from...
technically, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I can also imagine that the soundtrack is most of the time is kind of the last thing they do or one of the last things, because it all depends on the way the movie is edited. And, mm-hmm. well, the music has to kind of fill all the gaps. And so it might not be ready yet.
That's true.
I was reading somewhere that it was Peter Jackson or Howard Shore that were commenting on the score of the second film. Which will be released. It's hard to believe. It's like 70 days. It's like 3 months until this thing comes out.
Yeah.
Less. Here in the U.S. anyway. I remember it was there were comments that this score is going to be the first Hobbit score was very, very heavily influenced by Lord of the Rings. Some would say maybe too much, but I from things I've heard that it sounds like there will be a few more unique themes to this upcoming film.
Well, and don't forget that the score had to be kind of spread out a little bit because so much of what they wanted to put in the first movie was postponed and was moved to, well, the second movie now once they had a trilogy. And so I guess that also kind of explains why the first soundtrack wasn't the best because it was just a bit spun out and it lacked the variety that we were used to in The Lord of the Rings.
But I also think at the same time, perhaps the reason that it lacked variety too was that we didn't see much outside of the dwarves for the first movie. I mean, we did see the Shire and everything, but in the second movie, we will be seeing Legolas, we'll be seeing the elves, we'll be seeing Smaug.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Just exciting to me.
Even in this trailer, you saw so many different environments, and the atmosphere was just great.
And everyone else. So we'll be in so many different places that I imagine the music will really reflect that.
So the first scene we see is Bilbo entering Erebor. You see some big dwarven statues in the background. Actually, you know what was cool when I was in New Zealand? Everywhere you see the traces of Weta Studios, and on the airport, the international airport, there's actually one of those dwarven statues, and I don't think it's from The Hobbit, but it might be a leftover from the Lord of the Rings stuff. And it's just standing, like, near the food court. And it's so weird. And there's this huge prop. It's like two or three times my size. Enormous. And it looks like it's made out of stone, but if you look closer, it's just all this lightweight material, and it's completely fake. But when I saw the dwarves in the trailer, I was like, you know, I've seen one of those props. The other thing that struck me is that Bilbo is wearing different clothes. He now has a blue coat. It looks a bit more rough than his refined red coat that he had in the Shire. And of course, this is because I think it's Beorn that gives them new clothes, right?
Yes, and that would make perfect sense as he doesn't. The yellow handkerchief is nowhere to be found at this point in the story.
He can outuse his entire coat to blow his nose. But it does. It even looks a bit too big for him. So you can tell that Beorn didn't really prepare for, you know, all these small creatures that needed clothing.
Well, it's interesting, and the other part about that opening, that just first shot, is the performance by Martin Freeman is just where you hear the awe in his voice, the sincere awe at witnessing the dragon. And it's interesting, that's kind of how they bookend the trailer. They begin with hinting at Smaug, and then they end with the reveal of sorts. And I think that's a really cool thematic way of reminding everyone of the looming threat.
Now, do you think that this dialogue is taking place in the first encounter with Smaug, or is it... Because I did a search for everything in the trailer, all the phrases. Almost none of them are literally in the book. There is similar language, but almost every phrase that is uttered in this trailer is not originally from the book, at least not from the original version of the book.
Mm-hmm. I would think it would come from his first visual encounter with Smaug because of that awe that Riley mentioned. I mean, he's obviously terrified, but he's also completely just blown away. I mean, who wouldn't look at a dragon and think, well, you're also completely terrified that the dragon just looks amazing.
But it also seemed to me that Bilbo already understands that if he wants to keep this dragon from eating him, that he has to flatter him. It's almost as if he has already understood a little bit of the psychology of this dragon. You know,
that's
it's like,
true.
You are stupendous. I love that word. It's not in a book, but Smaug the Stupendous.
You know, is he prepared already to do that? Or has he been talking with Smaug and has figured all of this out?
I don't know.
I remember on the first theatrical trailer for the first Hobbit film, it's not coming to me immediately, but I'm trying to remember if they used any dialogue because
at the opening of
The Unexpected Journey, just the whole sequence of Gandalf's dialogue with Bilbo at the beginning is pretty much word for word straight out of the book. And it'd be interesting to see if there are any moments like that in this film or if this one might maybe drift a little bit further.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in the original story, Bilbo goes back to the dragon several times, and so perhaps this is a little bit after their initial encounter, you know, after that scene where Smaug is trying to find a thief, and this seems to be more like a prelude to the negotiations that are taking place. And there is a lot of dialogue in the book. So that's another question that I have, is like, how much will be in the movie?
I could see Peter Jackson maybe condensing the encounters down to one or two. And what you just said, Father, just actually made me think is that I think that must be a second encounter because he does use the word thief, which implies that Bilbo has already taken the cup, I believe it is.
So we see in the background, in the second frame or scene, we see Bilbo standing on a couple of stairs or on the bottom of a few stairs. In the background, you see amazing dwarven architecture. You know, I'm a huge fan of the Lord of the Rings online game, and it reminded me a lot of what you see in Moria, which is a huge area in the game. And it definitely has that same style. I was surprised to see how big the mountain is on the inside.
Yeah, but in a way, I had pictured it to be that large because of the way that Bilbo speaks about it, or the way that it's described in the books. Also, mm-hmm. what we saw of it in the first film, it was an amazing sight to see.
Yeah, definitely.
In the theater on the big screen.
But I guess that it's even bigger than what we saw in the first movie was just a very small part of the mountain. it's huge. In a way, it looks almost as big as Moria. Mm-hmm. Another thing that struck me, and we're also trying to identify, you know, what do we see and where in the movie does this fit? Because it's not necessarily all in chronological order. They will just take the fragments that work well with the narrative of the trailer. So here you see Bilbo standing on the bottom of these stairs, and he is like amazed. And there is this golden glow on his face and on his clothes, and even a bit on the background, you know, on the marble of the stairs, which makes me think, and the background is completely empty, so it makes me think that this is the moment where he first sees the treasure, and he sees how big it is, and it's just glowing. So that's, I think it's going to be a big reveal where, you know, he's been trying to find the dragon, trying to find the treasure, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa. Yeah. And it could also be the glow coming from Smaug himself. Perhaps there is a little campfire there, a little dragon fire that is causing the glow. But I think it's the treasure.
Well, and even the treasure could, perhaps I'm getting a bit too imaginative here, but the treasure could reflect off of Smaug's dragon scales as well, because, I mean, in the book he is described as... a sight to behold.
However, in the later part of the trailer, when we do see a glimpse, when we do get a glimpse of Smaug, he's pretty dark. He doesn't seem to glow at all,
mm-hmm.
except for the fire. Yes.
The light could be from his evil red eyes, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. He's got those eyes with built-in torchlight.
Exactly.
And then we see Bilbo climbing piles and piles of gold. That was the first time that I noticed that perhaps the special effects are not entirely finished yet, because it almost felt as if Bilbo was kind of pasted in, and that the background, you know, the treasure was a miniature, and he just stood out a little bit too much. The colors were too bright, and it just felt like he wasn't really climbing those piles of gold yet. But this is something that I learned when I was visiting Wellington just a few weeks ago, and I got a tour of the all the different premises that are used by Weta, because Weta is not just one big building, it's all over the city. And I was shown around by someone who's actually working on the movies in the animation department, and he told me that they actually keep working on the special effects sometimes like till like an hour before the premiere. It's unbelievable. And he even told me that the version that you see in theaters is never the finished version. If you want to see the finished version, you got to watch it on Blu-ray, because they actually, after the movie comes out, they will continue to work on the special effects to make them perfect. So that was a big revelation to me. I was like, I did not know that. But it just, there is so much to do for these special effects divisions, and there is just so much time pressure that oftentimes in a trailer they'll just use what they have and in the state that it is in. But actually, scenes might even change from the trailer to the movie that you will see in theaters. So this was a moment where I was like, this looks like it might need a little bit more polish here.
Yeah, they're not quite there, but like you say, and it's interesting because I bet that's something that depends on the director. Peter Jackson does strike me as the kind of person who won't be happy even after the theatrical release and wants to definitely polish things up.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, he's not like George Lucas, who just keeps, like, remaking the movie. but there is this desire to make it as good as they can within the time limit. And if the movie comes out too soon, then, well, you know, they still have, like, a second chance for the Blu-ray. And that will ultimately be the movie that we will remember. And so,
you see, just on a quick side question, have you seen the Blu-ray version of the Hobbit?
Or no, not yet. No, I'm waiting for the special edition because I was like, yeah, I'm not going to double dip. I've done that too often in my life.
I've seen the Blu-ray version twice now, and I don't remember anything jumping out to me too much. Other than, although I will say this, on Blu-ray, it was considerably better quality in terms of color.
Oh, really?
At the theater, but that often might be the theater, not the actual print of the film.
Did you see it in 48 frames per second?
No, it was just standard Blu-ray.
Oh, no, I mean in theaters.
Yes, we did. Yes.
Okay.
Didn't hardly notice the difference. It just felt a little bit more smooth. But then, I mean, 48 frames, that we don't have time to go into it now, but the whole 48 frames thing, it's odd. It's like politics. Everyone falls on such radically different sides depending on who you are.
Well, I've seen the first movie, I think, 8 times in the theaters because I've got this flat fee subscription to my local theater. And so I've seen it most of the times in 48 frames. And then once I actually made a mistake and I was watching a showing in 24 frames. It's like, oh, man, how can people watch this?
So you did then like the 48 frames better?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like the Retina screen on the iPhone. And once you go back to the older ones, you're like, how did I ever think that this was okay?
Well, that's the interesting thing is that I think a lot of it's, some of it's about experience and then some of it's just pure taste.
That too.
It'll be interesting to see how they move forward. But yeah, as far as, and then also on the special effects thing, Weta just, we do know this, regardless of what's in the trailer, they will knock it out of the park.
Oh, yes.
That's in
yes.
theaters.
It is just unbelievable. This trailer was already so much, had such an amazing wow factor compared to the teaser trailer. It was unbelievable. One of the shots that, for me, was a moment, a jaw-dropping moment, was the next shot that we saw, and it's in Mirkwood, and the elves are walking over a bridge in the direction of an entrance, and it's of course the entrance to Thranduil's cave, or, well, if we are purists, we should say the cave of the king, because he has no name. Thranduil is in the appendices and not in is it the appendices or the appendixes?
Appendices, usually always. It's interesting because I'm trying to remember my Tolkien lore, and so Thranduil's never mentioned in any edition of The Hobbit or like the original.
No, I think it's added later. I've just read the one that most of the people have read, so it's already reworked and it was revised in view of the Lord of the Rings that had already been written. But yeah, I think that Thranduil only appears later. And I remember I was reading Corey Olson's book, The Tolkien Professor, and he too, he's like, in my book, I'm not going to talk about Thranduil because it's officially not part of the Hobbit text. It was added later, and he wants to just, you know, talk about the original Hobbit story. But anyway, that's a detail. That shot was so beautiful, and I was like, wow, I never imagined it to look like this. And then I went back to the book and I read the description. And I just want to read it here because, and just try to picture that scene where you have this beautiful, it's kind of like fall, the trees have these yellow, beautiful yellow leaves, and there is this waterfall in the distance.
You're seeing something like, after being through something like Mirkwood, I remember just that sense when you read the book of just that sense of relief when you finally...
Yes.
Out of Mirkwood, and it's going to be nice to see that visually.
So let me read what what Tolkien wrote originally. Here's what he says. So they, of course, have been captured, and then suddenly the torches stopped, and the Hobbit had just time to catch them up before they began to cross the bridge. This was the bridge that led across the river to the king's doors. The water flowed dark and swift and strong beneath, and at the far end were gates before the mouth of a huge cave that ran into the side of a steep slope covered with trees. There the great beeches came right down to the bank till their feet were in the stream. Across this bridge, the elves trust their prisoners, but Bilbo hesitated in the rear. He did not at all like the look of the cavern mouth, and he only made up his mind not to desert his friends just in time to scuttle over at the heels of the fast elves before the great gates of the king closed behind them with a clang. Now, I think it's brilliant, and that entrance to the cave definitely had that menacing look. The bridge itself looks very organic, but then the entrance is like, wow, that is pretty dark. And of course, they don't know what will await them. They haven't been inside yet.
So it seems to be an edge of Thranduil in what we saw even briefly in the first Hobbit film that does seem a little threatening. I mean, he is a powerful ruler who seems to be willing to do what it takes to protect his people.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely more of an ambiguous character. And in this trailer, actually, they almost give it away. It's like, can you trust this guy? Yeah, he looks smooth, and apparently he has these amazing eyebrows. But what does that tell us about his reliability? What's his agenda, really? And I think they will use that, actually, that ambiguity, which is also in the book, to flesh out this whole... let's say the relationship between Legolas and Toriel as well, and then Toriel and Thranduil. So they enter the cave, and then the next one, the next scene is again something that we haven't seen in the teaser trailer. We've seen another part of the underground Elven King realm, but this time we get to see the chair of carven wood of the Elven King. And I think it looks great. It has these antlers, or at least looks like antlers on top of it, and then it's surrounded by pillars. That too is, if you watch it and then you read the book, it is exactly what Tolkien describes.
Which is the Elven King's crown, which I think visually it's like almost seeing a whole new race of elves. Well, it is seeing a whole new race of elves.
Yes, yes.
That we didn't see in Lord of the Rings. And it's neat to see the distinction there.
And to see the carved pillar in the background. And you can see that his throne also does have, like, it looks like royal cloth that's laid over it.
Yes.
So it really sets the stage for he is a powerful but elegant ruler.
And which is very cool, because I think what they are trying to do with the story is they position Thranduil as a true king, as someone who's very regal. And then, of course, there is the other king under the mountain, which is Thorin. And I there's been this setup in the first movie of Thorin versus Thranduil, which was traumatic for Thorin. And to me, it feels like they're bringing that back in this movie, and they're going to play it up, and it's going to create a lot of tension.
Yeah, it's remember in the trailer when Thorin says, when Bard is questioning him, Thorin says, "I have the only right."
Yes. Yes, you cannot enter the mountain, and it's like, you know.
Like, for instance, this piece of audio right here where he says,
"We have come to reclaim our homeland. I offer you my help."
Yes.
How do we know it won't betray us? We don't.
So, like, there, when he's talking about, it's so obviously a lack of trust, but he doesn't mind saying, "So, by the way, we're here and we're taking back our homeland."
Yes.
All 13 of us.
Try to stop us.
Right. Yeah.
The only issue that I had with the scene where we see the great hall and the chair, it did feel a little bit like a painting. But that might also have been just a lack of definition of the trailer on YouTube, but I was like, it's a little bit too perfect. But then again, it's a fairy tale, so everything is a little bit over the top. Then we see, we go to a whole different location. We see Thorin in the snow, and we've seen scenes similar to this one in the teaser trailer. I'm almost certain that this is in Lake Town, because what we've seen of Lake Town, it's snowing and it's really cold. Well, that's exactly the phrase that we just talked about. You know, we come to reclaim our homeland, which I think in the trailer really establishes the main quest. This is not just about the treasure, or about the dragon. This is about the dwarves taking back what belongs to them.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And then once, and that's what will hopefully make the third film so amazing is the fact that Thorin is the one who loses sight of what this quest is truly about, reclaiming their homeland, and it becomes about the treasure and the dragon.
Yes.
Which is really interesting to me, always has been, because you can see it in the first movie and you can see it in this trailer, but Thorin is bound and determined. That is his one focus. It's his main focus. It's really all that he seems to be able to think about when he talks of reclaiming the throne, of reclaiming their homeland, of reclaiming their right.
Well, and he feels responsible. I mean, he's the leader. He's now like the king of the dwarves. And so it's become his life mission to reclaim the mountain and reclaim the his homeland. So I like that as something, you know, it defines who he is. And without that, he would lose his soul, which actually might happen in a way. The next scene was a really puzzling to me. We see Thranduil in a close-up, and he is very regally again saying, "I offer you my help," which of course is meant to contrast with the first movie where he's not helping and he's walking away. He turns away. He's like, "This is, you know, I have fun, you know, I don't get involved." But I was wondering, where is this? Because, you know, it has to be later in the story when we first see Thranduil. He's just, he's locking up the dwarves and trying to teach them some manners.
Mm-hmm.
What are your theories about that?
I guess I would think that it is somewhere in the same scene that perhaps they have. I'm not sure, but I would guess that in order to make the story flow a little more along the lines of the main storyline, mm-hmm. that instead of just completely locking them up to teach them a lesson and have that whole experience that is in the books, that they might have a rough encounter with the elves to begin with, but then it turns into something else. Because we have Legolas, because we have Tauriel, because we have Thranduil, who all seem to be more main characters than they were in the book, I think the elves, while they might be suspect in the eyes of Thorin, the audience knows that Thorin is a suspicious, perhaps overly suspicious person. Mm-hmm. And I think that the audience will see the elves as good guys, basically. Thranduil offers him his help, and in the eyes of the audience, that might be more like what we have seen in the Lord of the Rings movies, where the elves do come to the aid of the humans.
I don't know. When Elrond says something like that, you know, "I will help you," I kind of believe him. But Thranduil, I was like, I don't like that guy. There is something too smooth about him. You know, he says he's going to help, but he's already betrayed the dwarves before. So perhaps I'm a little bit too much on the side of the dwarves. In Lord of the Rings Online, my main character is a dwarf. So perhaps I'm a little bit of my inner dwarf is now getting suspicious. But didn't you get that feeling that, you know, Thranduil, does he really want to help or not?
Just back to the when I read The Hobbit for the first time as a kid, I really, really disliked the elves.
He did. Because, we had arguments about it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because all of my older siblings are very much also into Tolkien. And if the story of The Hobbit is very layered. But at the time when I'm reading it for the first time, I want to root for Thorin. And you know, because later in the book, you have to consider the possibility that he might be wrong about something. But like in this case, I really, really hated.
Well, they are very unsympathetic, and they're making fun of the dwarves, and they seem to be so, you know, so prideful. So I don't know.
Legolas says in the trailer.
Say again.
Even with what Legolas says in the trailer, and Tauriel is, you know, Tauriel wants to join in on the fight, and Legolas and the other elves, so you do get that sense of dubiousness as to
yes.
You know, what are there?
Do we even want to be involved? Yeah. Well, the next scene is, again, a question mark for me. We see this boat, and it is it's very misty and murky, and there seems to be ice in the water, which I always associate with Lake Town. But then, you know, there's only one guy in the boat, and I was like, who is this, and where is this? Because this doesn't look like Lake Town. What we see looks more like ruins. Like the remains of an old fortress or something. So I was wondering, you know, they might try to make us think that this is Lake Town because they just needed a cool shot to kind of match the rest of what they were showing. But I was thinking, could this be Dol Guldur? That this is Gandalf, who's actually, I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because it, like, quickly following this is the shot of Thorin and Baldur. Dwalin.
Yes.
Victory. I feel like a strange and small sense of victory every time I remember the correct. but you'll notice, like, in the background, the lighting is exactly the same.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's a different boat, because there is obviously one person there, and then quick the next shot, you have the same background.
But I thought it was another boat. And you know, this time the dwarves are in the boat, and whereas in this first scene there's only one guy, at least as far as I can tell.
Well, you do only see the one person in the scene. If I don't think it's Gandalf, because there is no hat.
That's true. So it could just be. Could it be Bart? Because we know that Bart the Bowman in the movie actually will have a boat, and he's gonna be the guy, the one who picks up the dwarves after their river adventure.
That's probably, I think, the most likely candidate at this point, because that boat's almost certainly not the dwarves. Perhaps there is more than one boat, and it would be him sending off the dwarves, perhaps, to the mountain.
There are a lot of boats, actually, already in this trailer. I think there's also a location when I visited New Zealand. There is actually a location that was used by Peter Jackson that is called the shores of Lake Town. And so I was wondering, you know, perhaps that's it. Perhaps this is just, you know, some, you know, part of an abandoned part of the city, or just kind of the outskirts or something.
Or maybe like the remains, like an old city that was never rebuilt after it was ruined. Then you see a shot later, you see the boats again heading towards the mountain.
Yeah, but that's again another boat. It's yet another boat.
Or could it be the same boat? Because you do see ice and a little bit of fog left over.
Yeah, I don't know. Perhaps it's just, I was wondering, you know, who is this guy? But it's not very important. The shot of the boat in front of the big mountain of Erebor, of course, is something we've seen almost in the same way in the previous trailer, and it's a lovely shot. And you know, having now been in New Zealand, you think that you only see this stuff in the movies. And even though this actual mountain that we see in the movie is not real, but New Zealand actually really looks like that. It is that stunning. And it is just incredible. Anyway, just geeking out here.
It does sound gorgeous.
It is amazing. So the next shot we get is what I call a hero shot. It's just one of those shots that seem to be filmed for a trailer. And it's Thorin, but this time he is dressed as a king, and he's got this amazing armor in it. He just looks fantastic.
He's got this slightly circling, panning shot, and his hair is fluttering in the wind. And
yeah, and you forget that this guy is just tiny. He's just a tiny dwarf. He looks just massive.
mm-hmm.
So, and
Thorin is quite an imposing figure in spite of his size.
Yes. And it's only when you see him talking to Bart the Bowman that you're just like, wow, Thorin is really small.
It's Richard Armitage, who just has that intimidating factor to him.
Yeah, it's a bit like Sylvester Stallone, you know? We know that in most of his movies, he stipulated that the camera always has to be lower than his eyes are, so that people in the theaters think that he's big, but he's not. He's a tiny guy. He's a dwarf. Anyway, we should.
After which point, now the trailer starts to get really interesting.
Yes.
We start getting reveals from some stuff, not so much from the book.
Indeed. So we see the secret entrance via the statue again, which I still love, that staircase. So they're trying to enter Erebor. And I think that we also see other scenes where they are trying to get inside, but the dragon is just keeping them from entering. So this might be just like trying to find a less dangerous way to get into the mountain. I don't know. And then we get to the interesting part, which is indeed non-canon. We see Legolas and Toriel. Some scenes of the barrels again. And there is an orc attack taking place. Now, this is all in Mirkwood. And Toriel, in the meantime, is warning Legolas that if they don't do something, evil will grow. If they don't fight, evil will grow, which is also something that was in the teaser trailer. It's all about this question, should we get involved, or is this just a dwarven problem? And Toriel seems to be the voice of reason. It's like, you know, this is bigger than the dwarves.
Yeah. It almost makes you wonder if she knows something. It's not just her viewpoint, but perhaps she has access to information that, say, her father also has, but she does view it differently.
Well, and so this orc attack takes place during Beryl's out of bond.
You think so?
Yes, I can actually confirm that, because one of the shots, the very first shot of it, right after the hero shot of Thorin and the staircase, the first thing you'll see is in the water below, as Legolas are filled, you'll see a dwarf pop up.
Oh.
I see that. Yes.
I don't know if I just made a discovery or if this is already known. But yeah, if you pop down, it's like 37 seconds in, 36, 37 seconds in, and you'll see, I think it's Bomber, pop out of the water below them.
Oh, wow. No, I totally missed that. So it's at 37 seconds? Let me...
Yeah, yeah. So 36 to 37, and that's where you'll see. It's kind of an up shot of the action of Legolas and Toriel.
Hold on. It's playing. It's playing the audio. Sorry, it's getting a bit messy. 37 seconds. Let me see.
Well, and if this is the case, I don't know if this is much of a discovery, but I think it'd be kind of point to a way that they're trying to make Beryl's out of bond a bit more adventurous.
Oh, well, that's for sure. I mean, it's way bigger, and it almost looks like a theme park thrill ride. And it's much longer.
I would totally go on that Disney ride.
Oh, yeah, me too.
So you think, Riley, that the orcs are attacking the dwarves and Legolas and Toriel come to the rescue type of thing?
I could see that, because that would fit with the conversation that takes place beforehand, saying we have to do something. Mm-hmm. And so they save the dwarves from being...
Well, and then let's not forget that the orcs are still after the dwarves. So this is a good moment to reintroduce them and to show that they are still on their trail, and they're actually attacking.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, because of course that story thread is... It's also in the trailer. We do see the white orc. We're reminded of that is unfinished business. So the interesting scene that follows this also shows us the elves, Legolas, fighting. But this was so weird, and I'd love to talk about this a little bit more in depth, because we see Legolas and he's sword fighting, and he's not in Mirkwood. He is in, well, what looks like an old town. It again, there's snow, so this has to be Lake Town. What the heck is he doing there? And he's fighting what looks like an orc, and then all of a sudden he's inside an old house, and it looks almost as if it's a ship or something, but it could also be just a like an older part of the city. And he's using these knives, and he pulls them out of his, from behind his back like a ninja. What did you think of that?
Well, go ahead, Bethany.
Well, it is interesting to me because, well, it's kind of like its own little glory shot of Legolas in and of itself, of which there are several in the trailer. But it's interesting to see Legolas take such a role in the trailer that he seems to, like,
I cannot tell who he's fighting.
And Tauriel are really being the face of the elves to some degree. It's almost as if they are additional members of the company in a way, because of all this orc fighting that they're doing and the interacting with the dwarves and the fact that Tauriel does think that they should get involved.
Yes.
So I really do wonder how big of a role Legolas will play in this film, because given the trailer, it seems like it will be relatively large.
Well, and of course, you know, he is selling the movie right now. Let's not forget that this guy has a huge audience of fans, also the Pirates of the Caribbean fan base, and of course they want to get them in the theaters. So Orlando Bloom, if you have him, you want to use him, right? But what it tells me is that actually the story is modified quite substantially. And instead of what I always thought was that it would end after the barrel scene, and, well, Tauriel and Legolas would just have this little chat. It's like, yeah, I told you we should get involved. Oh, well, we'll see. And then the next time we would see them would be during the Battle of Five Armies. But now it seems to me, and there's more proof in this trailer, that they actually pursue the dwarves, and they will actually help them.
That's what I meant by it almost seems like they might become additional members
but
of
that
quest, almost.
That would be so shocking, because that is definitely going way beyond what Tolkien intended to do. And this is also beyond what we read in the appendices.
If I were to throw my two cents, knowing Peter Jackson's work well enough, I don't think that they would be quote unquote members of the quest. I could see them kind of being kind of mini Gandalf, so to speak, like they show up and then help save the day and then disappear, which Gandalf does throughout the whole book. And I think that thematically would still keep the original story intact. If they do that. Although if it's like, well, what a bum lunch off of us every day and just kind of go on this fun road trip. You know, that's not going to work. But I don't know. It is tough to tell.
It's very. There was another thought that I forgot to mention earlier on, when we wondered if Tauriel knew something more than Legolas. I think that we've speculated about this in the past. Tauriel might also be the one who actually is like a guardian in the prison part of the king, and so perhaps she has conversations with the dwarves, and that's when she sympathizes more with them, and
that,
you know,
yeah.
Well, and that would not be the first time Peter Jackson has replaced the role of a minor role of a male elf and then inserted a larger role for a female elf.
And I think it could work, because then you get Legolas as being kind of torn between Tauriel, which he seems to care for, and his father, which I think narratively is very interesting, and it also allows some character development. So that would be very smart, and I think that if Tauriel really kind of starts to care for these dwarves, that might explain why she convinces Legolas, in spite of his father, to go after the dwarves and try to help them as much as they can. Plus, what it will also do is to keep the elves in the picture for the rest of the movie, which will help bridge the gap with the third movie, where the elves are coming back. And I think in the original Hobbit, they kind of disappear for a while and they're not mentioned anymore. But that's because it's a book and it's a short book. But in the movie, it would almost feel a little bit... They would be out of the picture for too long and we would forget about them. And then once they come back in the Battle of Five Armies, it would be a little bit too much of a deus ex machina.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting too, because I wonder what Thranduil's relationship with Tauriel is, because that little conversation that they have, where he says, "Don't give Legolas hope where there isn't."
Yes. Any.
And it makes me very curious as to what their relationship is.
That's not the nicest thing to say. Well, no, I like you, but I just really want my son to stay very far away from you.
Yes. Well,
or if he has a relationship with her to where he knows that maybe she doesn't like Legolas in that way.
Well, we know this isn't
be odd.
This is not a happily ever after story.
No.
That's going to happen here. This
no.
is not the Titanic will sink. We do know the outcome.
And I've predicted many times before that Toriel will actually die in the Battle of Five Armies.
Father, the first time I heard that theory, I was so angry because of, A, I hadn't thought of it. So, brilliant. And then second, I'm like, he's totally right.
She's got to die. It just gives emotional weight to the Battle of Five Armies. You need to care for people for that battle to matter, and I think they're setting it up right now. But anyway, what I was surprised by this scene where she's talking to Thranduil. Because, of course, it seems to imply that this is like a mirror image of the scenes with Elrond and Arwen.
Yes.
Where Elrond is, you know, oh, my daughter, don't do this, you know. You'll grow old and he'll die. And so, but I wonder, they seem to imply that this is about love, you know, that Legolas has special feelings for Toriel. And that when Thranduil says, well, don't give him hope where there is none, that he's talking about love. But what if he's actually talking about helping the dwarves and fighting? You know, don't give him hope where there's none. These dwarves are actually goners. You know, don't try to convince my son that there is this is actually a cause worth fighting for.
Well, and here's the thing. I think that's a really interesting theory because people do often jump to the conclusion that you've got Evangeline Lilly and Orlando Bloom, so they must fall in love or something like that. And I think that'd be a very interesting theory to explore as to is it not in fact about romance, but instead about the dwarves. The only factor I think that really, really weighs in heavily is that this is Hollywood. So it's about romance.
Well, actually, it's not Hollywood. This is Wellington. So they might surprise us.
I hope you are right, Father. Although I do think that this is more about a constructed romance.
Well, and if you think about it, though, again, I said it was odd because he is speaking about his son, not his daughter.
Yes.
You yeah. would expect that dynamic out of Elrond because Arwen is his daughter. But for Thranduil to be speaking with Toriel like this, it just seems odd. And that would also play into the fact of can you really trust Thranduil from the dwarf's perspective? Because if he's not bought into this and he's like, well, you know, they're goners anyway. Don't give them hope. Don't give Legolas hope. Just let them go and get roasted by a dragon.
I'll tell you what, you Thranduil, know? The absolute ball of cheery optimism.
I just wonder what this hope, what hope he's talking about, you know, what does it imply? And I feel that it has something to do with, you know, with the agenda of Thranduil, perhaps, or you know, what could be the motivator for Thranduil and for Legolas? What do they want to accomplish? Is it just protecting? Then it seems to protecting Mirkwood, and it seems to be illogical that is hope. Or I'm just a bit confused. But I'm almost certain that we won't see a romance. I think there will be romantic tension, perhaps, between the two, but I don't think it's going to be a full-fledged romance. I've not seen anything in the information that was released, even, you know, when the first movie came out, and they still thought that the whole Mirkwood would be part of the first movie. In the character descriptions, there was nothing that led us to believe that these two were in love. And I think that it's more, I see it more as a, perhaps, you know, brother, older sister type of relationship. Where they respect each other, they like each other, they care for each other, but it's because they're fighting for the same cause.
Yeah, I wish you were one of the producers
this
on the movie or part of the writing team.
What are you
I
doing
really
podcasting
did...
about this stuff? You need to be doing, and you need to be in the storyboard room.
No. They've already thought of that before me. I just think they're very smart writers. So. Yeah. Well, we'll see. This is also part of kind of the game, you know, trying to guess what we will see and what the movie will actually be. And we've been right about certain things for the first movie, and we've been terribly wrong on other things as well.
Yeah, but I would definitely love to see that dynamic. That would be an interesting one for sure.
I think it's definitely more interesting, and it will also make Legolas more believable, because otherwise, you know, we would get a depressed elf in The Lord of the Rings.
Well, and then think about this. I think if your theory is correct, which I think it is, about her sacrificing herself at the Battle of the Five Armies, in some ways it's more impactful if it's a great friendship that's, you know, may have been, may have someday been a romance, but it isn't an explicit, you know, romantic loss. And I think that in some ways, friendship in Tolkien is such a more powerful theme than even romance is.
Yes, definitely.
But that would be consistent with Tolkien's style of writing.
It would definitely be more respectful towards Tolkien if this was just, you know, a friendship and not a romance. I think it would upset the fans less. But it would be kind of smart because they seem to, and that's what a trailer does, you know, they seem to imply things that this is just your regular Hollywood movie, and then the actual movie might go in a different direction that you didn't see coming.
That, and even if you think about movie making these days, there are movies where they're beginning to move more in that direction. You don't have the typical romance between male and female. I was actually going to bring that up, but for instance, in
in
the Hunger Games
film. Oh, the Hunger Games.
Sling from.
Sorry, and I couldn't help myself.
In the Avengers, both have female characters that, they may have romantic interests, they are first and foremost.
It's not the point of the character, sure.
It is not.
They're too busy for romance.
Exactly. And then if you're thinking about it, I might be, I'm also a huge Narnia fan, and I'm still kind of wounded from the end of Prince Caspian, where they artificially threw in a romantic scene between Susan and Prince Caspian, which was absolutely had nothing to do with the book. And it didn't bother me as much as it did many C.S. Lewis fans, but it was still one of those things of, I think that comes from an era of Hollywood where there are certain check boxes that you have to check to have a successful movie. And one of those is that, you have to have the romance.
Right. It would be interesting to see if the female character of Toriel was introduced for, you know, legitimate reasons, just to kind of tell an interesting story about these characters. And I think what we see, the glimpses that we get, it is going to be an interesting relationship, and it will actually create a lot of opportunities for character development. First and foremost, in the character of Legolas, who kind of was, he was a great elf, but also a bit bland. He's the least interesting character in The Lord of the Rings.
He seems to be the least developed character in The Lord of the Rings.
Except Farmer Maggot.
Sure. Let's see, where were we? There's this whole Thranduil Toriel. And then, we get another shot of Dale, similar to the one that we saw in the teaser trailer. So it's located on the mountainside. Again, looks very much like the real thing in New Zealand. A conversation between Bart and Thorin in Lake Town. This is the famous one with, "You have no right to enter the mountain. I have the only right."
What a great quote, too, by the way. Again, it's odd because this trailer, as you said, has very few direct quotes. But, like, thematically, it hits a lot of themes just pitch perfectly, and I think this was one of those moments.
Yes, this is not in the book, but I think that actually Peter Jackson, what he did was to highlight kind of like an imminent theme, a theme that was there right under our noses, but Tolkien does not really emphasize it. But it's right there; you can feel it. This is about more than treasure, and they make it just more explicit, and I think they do it brilliantly. And then we get to see, finally, we see Bilbo again. You know, this is all about the Hobbit. And it's him against the spiders. What did you think of that?
I was terrified. I hate spiders.
Nice and succinct, Bethany. I totally agree with you, actually. Oh, man. As a kid reading The Hobbit, that was probably one of the... That and The Riddles in the Dark were the two scariest scenes in the book. And then, of course, later I read, you know, Shelob's Lair. And that was that. Yeah. That takes the cake. But it's interesting because they don't just hint at the spiders. And here's an interesting philosophy that they seem to be approaching with these trailers. And I think the spiders is a good way, and Smaug the dragon, is that they're not really worried about being subtle about what they're hinting at in the film.
Yeah.
They really do want to show off what they've done with it so far. And that includes like the spiders. And it's part of me wants it to be more vague, like not really know what it's going to be like until the film. And the other part of me thinks that well, you've worked hard on a project and you want to show off your wares. So yes. I can kind of see both sides of it, but the spiders is an example of that.
Well, and I do think that they kind of did both, because while they do very explicitly show certain things like the spiders, we did kind of see Smaug, but not completely, not entirely.
I agree.
We never got a definitive shot of Smaug. And while I was still very impressed nonetheless, I think that we may go into the film not yet knowing Smaug fully looks like.
Yeah, they show just enough to keep us interested. But even the spiders, you just see a little bit glimpses of them. But what struck me was that the spiders seem to be much more agile and aggressive than we saw them in The Lord of the Rings. And it really strike me as, you know, you have these spiders that actually jump at you when you try to kill them. And that's what I felt like, oh my gosh, we're going to have some jump out of your seat moments here, especially if this isn't going to be in 3D, so.
yes. I'll tell you what, if they do the lazy Lob and Crazy Cobb poem/song, I don't care where I am or when I'm watching it in the theater, I'm standing up and cheering.
It's such a great song.
It is one of those things where, like, when they were first adapting the film, there's a, like, for instance, when the dwarves first arrive at Elrond's, and there's those silly poems and stanzas that are recited, and people say that'll never work, and Peter Jackson ended up not using it. This is a case where I think Martin Freeman's performance could actually be well used for something like that.
Yeah,
but I don't know. Who knows?
It's going to be interesting. There were more songs and poems in the first movie than I thought they would do, so who knows? Then we go to Gandalf in Dol Guldur. This is definitely Dol Guldur. It looks amazing. I mean, we've seen just a very small part of this, and it is so much bigger than we saw in the first movie. I love that quote. You know, we've been blind, and in the meantime, you know, evil has been growing, and just classic Gandalf stuff. And then we get a very intriguing shot of marching orc armies. It's like, and in the background, you see runes, and it's like, where is this? This is also Dol Guldur? And when is this? This looks more like a scene from The Five Armies, but they're not going to show us that.
I mean, because
do they
you
get
can
that
see,
far?
You can see sky in the background. If you look, you can see clouds in the upper right-hand corner of the screen.
Uh-huh.
You can see what looks like ruins, too, so it could be Dol Guldur, but yeah.
I think it's Dol Guldur, but I don't know where the army's coming from. I guess, I mean, in the appendices, they do go into how Sauron first begins to build his forces there, so I guess they really are going to show it to us fully.
Well, and then, of course, we have this big lingering question. Is the attack on Dol Guldur, there is a confrontation between the necromancer and his powers and, well, at least part of the White Council. So is this actually, are they going to amplify it in the sense that we will first see a Gandalf just exploring and then, you know, and then going back, and then there will be this big fight? Actually, this might be one of the secret elements that they've not shown us. And there's a few other things that we still don't know what it's going to mean, how they're going to visualize it. We still haven't seen the Master of Lake Town, which is quite crazy. So perhaps this is just one of the surprises that they will keep. And this is the only shot in the entire trailer that shows us an army of orcs.
I think that might be the greatest part of the mystery that they've left out, because I can't imagine you would have material like that from the appendices and not take advantage of it. I could definitely see them fleshing out that confrontation for sure.
Yeah, and if this is a full-fledged battle, then could it be that actually Legolas and Toriel get involved in that as well, and that the fighting that we saw was actually in Dol Guldur and not in Mirkwood? I don't know.
My theory about that is no, in that, because like in a moment we'll see a shot of Legolas and Toriel fighting the spiders.
Yes, so true.
So I think that they'll be close weaving in and out of the dwarf story, or as Bethany said, tagging along with the dwarf's journey, to where that I don't really see them popping over to Mirkwood. Although as they go through Mirkwood, they do pass in close proximity. It's one wonders.
We then see Gandalf, who is running alone, fighting. And then we get this I mean, this is just a fraction of a second, but we see the eye of Sauron. Did you see that?
Yes.
Like, holy moly.
I wrote that down because I didn't know what they intend to hint at with that. Is he involved somehow like that?
Well, I'm thinking this must be the necromancer. It must be the necromancer.
Mm-hmm.
And we've only seen him as almost like a ghost-like figure very briefly in the first movie. And so I was like, are we really going to see this eye? That seems to be a little bit early. Or is it just like a shock effect just to remind us that, you know, the necromancer is actually Sauron?
It's the trailer marketing equivalent of boo!
Yeah, it was. But I was like, whoa! And this is a right around the point that we also get to see the ring. So it could just be a trick to help us make the connection with Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
But it was unexpected. I was like, why? I really didn't think we would see this eye. Because it's not in The Hobbit.
Well, and I think that kind of points to just how much they're trying. The whole marketing of both Hobbit films so far really strikes to me a sense of, remember Lord of the Rings.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I think that's good and bad in some ways. And it's interesting because I think Peter Jackson had made the decision up front, we are not adapting The Hobbit as a book. We are adapting the story of The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
Where and that's one thing that as a huge Tolkien fan that drives me nuts when people complain about the fact of, man, they're making three movies out of one little book. Isn't it a play for money? And you don't know Peter Jackson. He's taking the material. Because it is a tough decision because I would love to go see a movie that was just The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
I would see it like a PG film mm-hmm. that was made by, you know, Warner Brothers or Disney. And it was just an adaptation as I read The Hobbit. And I think that'd be a fun ride. But if you ask me to choose between that and a fully fleshed out tale of the epic that is the story of what leads to Lord of the Rings, I'd choose the latter.
Oh, definitely. And that's
when we come to seeing Dol Guldur and the build up there and the Battle of the Five Armies and the significance of the ring and seeing Sauron. That marketing and that style is consistent with the fact of this is more than just an adventure of a, you know, Hobbit and 13 Dwarves. Yes.
This is why I was a little puzzled when the initial Hobbit movie came out and did not get some very great reviews from certain people, because I thought that Peter Jackson walked the line between the two perfectly, in that he had elements of The Hobbit as a children's story, elements of fun and silliness and, you know, cracking plates and chipping mugs and, you know, Bilbo fainting and the handkerchief and all these really adorable moments in the film. But it also is broadening out. We're not just seeing The Hobbit from The Hobbit's perspective anymore.
Right.
And I think that that's a better telling of the story in a way, because it gives the audience more. It shows the audience what's going on in Middle Earth as a whole,
and
not just from the Hobbit's point of view.
In a way, this is very similar to, I always use the analogy with Bible stories in the Old Testament, where you will read about these wars, but if you look closely and you look at the context and the historical stuff that we know, oftentimes these stories are retellings, and sometimes they've been retold and written down generations after the event, and the story, the original story, is still there, but there have been extra layers and new elements that actually give depth to that original event. And that's how I kind of feel the evolution of The Hobbit. There was this very charming, beautiful, condensed story, and then Tolkien just started to add layers and make it bigger and deeper. And I think that the movies actually are adding even to these layers, and are in the same, using the same recipe, they're adding variations and just enhancing the dish. Or if you want to use a musical melody, it's like these. There's the original melody, and then you add more and more instruments, and the orchestra will not just play the notes on paper, even though it's Mozart who wrote them, but the orchestra and the director will actually add layers of interpretation to it.
Exactly, and I think that's a beautiful analogy for it. And I think
yes, and I especially think beautiful because everybody knows that hobbits love food. So I'm
getting hungry now.
Yes,
that's a great. Most of the listeners to this podcast would agree that that's the best way to approach these films.
And I really like the way that you approach that, Father Roderick, too, because it does. I do think that the approach of I guess you could call them Hobbit purists, mm-hmm. perhaps. I think the approach is it's not necessarily narrow-minded as much as it excludes the possibility for more. It you don't allow for the story to become more than it was from just Bilbo's perspective, because I mean Tolkien did go back and add, like you were saying, so much to the story.
Yeah. And I mean, it all has to do with expectations. And some people just want to see the original stuff. It's like, you know, Star Wars, since we're all Star Wars fans here. You know, you got the original version of 4, 5, and 6. And then you've got the special editions or the you know, like, did it really need those extra CGI characters? And some people hate them and others don't. But it's all... George Lucas always said, you know, a movie is never finished, it's abandoned. And that's kind of true with stories as well. Every time a story is told, it will get another meaning. I think that some people are upset because this seems to be like the definitive version of these stories. But perhaps in a century from now, there will be another guy or girl who is going to redo these stories and will tell the stories very differently. I don't have a problem with it, and I'm just intrigued and kind of mesmerized by the intelligent way in which Philippa Boyens and Peter Jackson and all the other writers that are not always mentioned but that must be there, and even the actors have added to the layering of this story. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've definitely talked enough to take a short break here, because well, believe it or not, but we're already an hour and 16 minutes into this analysis of the trailer, which is totally typical. I remember that the teaser trailer, which is like half the length of this one, took us like, I don't know, like 3 episodes to talk about. So we're gonna just take a break and let our listeners relax their ears a little bit and get some second breakfast, and then we will be back very soon with the rest of our analysis of this story. And so you've been listening to Bethany and Riley, the hosts of the Star Wars Report. And if you're into Star Wars, if you're only remotely interested into Star Wars, you definitely want to check out their podcast. So Star Wars Report, there will be, of course, links in the show notes. I am Father Roderick. I'm the host of The Secrets of Middle Earth, of The Hobbit, and I've done a ton of other shows as well. You can find them all on sqpn.com, which is the website of the StarQuest Production Network. So that's sqpn.com for all the other shows. And if you want to see something of my adventures in New Zealand or Middle Earth, then you might want to keep an eye on my YouTube feed. I'm R. Von Hogen on YouTube. It's not the most marketable name, so it's R-V-O-N-H-O-G-E-N. And I'm still editing a lot of the material, but once I get to the New Zealand stuff, prepare your mind to be blown, because my mind was, and my eyes were blown. Everything was blown. It was just the most amazing country in the world. And of course, I have filmed a lot on these Hobbit and Tolkien related locations. So check that out on YouTube, and links to all this will be in the show notes. And we will be back soon with the rest of our analysis of the Desolation of Smaug. And well, if we are talking so much about just a short trailer, imagine what will happen once the movie comes out. This podcast will never end. So, once again, Bethany and Riley, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's our pleasure.
And we will be back soon with more. Take care, and may the hair on your toes never fall off, or something like that.
May the hair on your toes be with you.
That's a good one. So say we all.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.